And it's frankly surprising to me. Sometimes you can't even tell. Sometimes it's the person who you least suspect will do the bravest thing that ultimately just rises to the occasion. And it really takes being in the moment. And that includes for us. When you've been literally under fire, when I've been literally under fire, how do you react in that moment really is the determinant of whether or not you're going to take those steps. But it's fascinating because you see people. That person's going to turn and run. No, they're standing the ground, which is also, I already mentioned the Congressional Medal of Honors recipients. You read some of those studies, you read some of those case studies and some of the biographies that have been written by some of these folks. They're just normal people who in the moment, that bravery just flares.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to part two of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Our guest this week is Steve Hirsch, who, if you listened in yesterday, you know, is retired after 30 years with the Central Intelligence Agency. And he's not, he's telling us he's not a spy, but if he was, I don't think he'd tell us anyway. I haven't been able to detect any deception here, and I'm watching him closely on the screen as we talk. And for those of you that are listening on audio, you probably should come over to YouTube and so you can see the video of this and make up your own determination because don't believe what Murph says, right?
That's take a poll. Is he lying?
It's a cheesy commercial, isn't it? But seriously, welcome back to part two. And let's just get right back into it because I've got a ton of questions to cover over the next hour. And I know we're not going to get to everything. But Steve, thank you for coming back, sir. Welcome back.
My pleasure.
First question is it possible to train someone to be brave?
Wow. Is it possible to be someone to be brave? I think that you can train them to be prepared for the moment. And I think you can do a lot of great work there, particularly around the things like critical thinking that we talked about. But ultimately, I think that's more a function of your character than anything that training can do.
That's a good answer. Cause I tell you what, I guess this is a self revelation, but you watch these spy movies out there with Jack Ryan and Jason Bourne and, The Americans and all these different shows that are out there. And you watch the things that they're doing and the close calls that they have. And I can project myself into that position just internally. I'm not voicing this out to my wife or anybody, just thinking, could I do that? How would I get out of this situation? Why did I get myself in this situation to start with? And I mean, I don't understand. I don't think I am brave. I think that's the problem.
Well, I will challenge you on that.
Well, I am an idiot. I'll tell you that.
What I would say is you've been in many situations where you've had to see people react in those moments, right? And it's frankly surprising to me. Sometimes you can't even tell. Sometimes it's the person who you least suspect will do the bravest thing that ultimately just rises to the occasion. And it really takes being in the moment. And that includes for us. When you've been literally under fire, when I've been literally under fire, how do you react in that moment really is the determinant of whether or not you're going to take those steps. But it's fascinating because you see people, that person's going to turn and run. No, they're standing the ground. I already mentioned the Congressional Medal of Honors recipients. You read some of those studies, you read some of those case studies and some of the biographies that have been written by some of these folks. They're just normal people who in the moment, that bravery just flares, which is, it's just fascinating to me. So I think that you can train people to be ready. I don't think that you can train people and prepare for people, whatever is the character, the framework of their character.
Yeah. Do you think that secrecy becomes addictive, especially as a CIA employee?
I think secrecy becomes convenient, very convenient. And it allows you to say, I can't tell you that. I can't tell you that. I'm not at liberty to tell you that. I'm not at liberty to tell you that. And there have been times in my own life where I just don't want to talk about something. So could I have told you? Probably. But at the same time, I'm just going to fall back on, I can't tell you. If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Yeah.
That whole thing. So I think it becomes convenient. And then perhaps it becomes addictive after its convenience. But one of the challenges, I think, that the agency, but also all of the intelligence community, and it's not just the intelligence community, and I know that the FBI, for example, is technically a part of the intelligence community, but all of these organizations, we get so focused on, we do things in a classified setting, we can't tell anybody, we can't release this to the public, that it becomes, again, that convenient thing, when in fact, you absolutely can. And sometimes I think what that does is it tends to lead us in a direction where we preclude things that are not classified. We preclude things that perhaps somebody said, but it's not in a classified setting. I don't have it in my traffic. Some spy didn't tell me this, so I'm not going to take that for granted. And this is, hopefully we're not going to get into this, but this is one of the challenges that I think that the intelligence community, but the whole federal government faces on open source intelligence, right? Just because something's open source doesn't make it any better or any worse necessarily than some of the things we've got today. And I have some colleagues, one of my best friends, in fact, is heading an organization that's all about open source intelligence. Some amazing information there, particularly as the internet just continues to explode and explode and explode. The amount of information you can draw and the real-time intelligence you can create with that, we need to be more careful.
Absolutely. And it's, I kind of said that question tongue-in-cheek because we had a neighbor who, her and her husband both worked for the agency. And when I retired, I did background investigations. I got bored doing the Narcos thing with Netflix, and I get bored real easy, so I try to stay real busy. And I think I knew what her position was, but she was so secretive about everything. And she was talking about, something came up, and I said, "Where's your new office at?" Oh, it's like I slapped her with a stick. "I can't tell you that." I'm thinking, you're probably a secretary. That's what I think you are. And I probably do background reinvestigations at the facility where you work. I was just, you know, it seems like some people want to portray that they're the James Bond of modern day intelligence work.
Right. And if it's classified, you don't know that they're simply doing accountant work or lawyer work. And by the way, I deeply respect the accountants and the lawyers. Absolutely. I have some great, great friends who are lawyers, and they probably kept me out of jail a lot, as opposed to being overseas, cloak and dagger kinds of stuff.
Yeah. There was, and as I mentioned, after retirement, I was doing these background investigations, and I was a contractor. So I'm not investigating CIA employees. I'm investigating CIA contractors, many of who are retired CIA employees.
Funny how that works.
Oh, after I learned about the system, man, you guys have got it figured out. You take care of your own. That was very admirable, I thought. But I know there was this one lady, and she was a contract secretary, and she had continued in the same position she had when she was on the job. And just as one of the sweetest older ladies I've ever met in my life, and it was time for her re-up on her security clearance, and I called her, and you call, make an appointment, and she's in Langley, and I'm explaining everything to her, and she says, "I can't tell you any of this." And I said, "Miss So-and-so, this is just so you can continue to keep your security clearance, so you can continue to keep your jobs." And she's like, "I'm going to have to talk to somebody. I'm not giving you clearance to come into Langley." So I said, "Well, go talk to your boss, let him explain it to you, and then I'll call you back tomorrow and let's set up an appointment." So I did. She's like, "He's telling me I can talk to you, but I'm just not comfortable about this." And I said, "Dear, you're going to lose your job if we don't do this. I promise you, I'm not going to ask you any secrets. It's just about your background." And so finally we got through it, but that was one of the most painful interviews I had to do.
I mean, background investigations are a natural part of our world, as are, and I've heard you talk about polygraphs on many, many of your podcasts. It's just part of our world. So it's surprising to me that you actually went through that. Every 5 or 10 years or so, it's like, "Oh, background investigators here. All right."
I had one guy that wouldn't let me come into the facility because he didn't tell me where it was. So we met in a shopping center parking lot a few blocks from where his building was that I'd been to multiple times to talk to other people. It's funny. It was just funny the way people, and you want to make them comfortable because if you don't, they're not going to talk to you. But it got to the point where we were with a private company that was contracted by OPM, Office of Personnel Management, to do these investigations. And finally, our boss called us and said, "Hey, everybody, we're having a meeting over at the CIA campus out there in Loudoun. I won't say where it is, but it's pretty well known if you live in Loudoun where that is." And so we all go out there, and it was some CIA security people coming to explain to us why people were so hesitant to talk to us. And they're telling us they're not being rude to you. This is, we beat this into our employees about secrecy, and some people just take it to the nth degree. And it was just gave us a better understanding how the agency works. But that's got nothing to do with your story. It's just side notes here.
I've had to go through background investigations and polygraphs. So, you know,
yeah,
I never gave anybody a hard time. I want to go on record. I never gave anybody a hard time for meeting with me wherever I was working.
We were contractors, so it didn't, you know, that's contractors, just get rid of them.
It's funny you say that, and because you were a background investigator. I always knew I was having a background investigation because my friends and family would call me and say, "Oh, they're at it again. They're asking questions." Like, that's how I would know. Okay, all right. So I guess it's that time again.
at the company I was working for, my boss was a retired DEA agent. Now, I was senior executive service. We call it special agent charge in DEA, and he made it up to assistant special agent charge, which is a GS-15 level. And after we went through the interview and everything, he came to me, he says, we go to his office, and his biggest question was, he said, "Listen, boss," he's calling me boss. He said, "Are you going to be okay if I have to give you instructions?" I'm like, "Absolutely. I recognize authority here. What you're doing, I'm the new guy here." So, and it worked out great, but it was nice of him to be respectful enough to ask me that question.
Did you give him any swag?
None. That's before we really got rolling.
Okay. You know,
Narcos hadn't come out yet, and Murph, I just got bored, to be honest with you.
No, it happens.
Only time in my entire life I've had my entire honey-do list done. My wife was so happy. It hasn't happened since. Do you see the lifestyle within the CIA? Is that compatible with marriages, or do you see a lot of divorces?
So I don't know what the statistics are. I mean, there's a lot of divorces, just period, in the outside world. I think so the agency, like I would hope, most federal agencies where people are in danger, the agency, it takes care of its own. It has a very strong reputation for taking care of its own. And one of the things it does by taking care of its own is it takes care of families. And it takes care of families in deep and profound ways. When someone is sent overseas, particularly to some danger areas, we have ways for spouses, families, children to reach out to the organization, to reach out to the agency if they need anything, particularly around insurance or medical claims or any of that kind of stuff. And that is a part of going overseas. That is a part of going into dangerous places. And it very much, and there's family groups that come in, they're constantly reaching out to families of folks who are going overseas. And then, sadly, I mean, many, many people are aware of the memorial wall we have at the agency, which we all take very seriously. It's the wall of stars, where those who have died, in the line of duty, we take care of their spouses. We take care of their kids. We've got scholarships. We've got all kinds of things we do to take care of the families, who have been affected by that. So is it hard? I think it is. But the agency does everything it can to take care of people, including direct lines back in to the organization. I think we already talked about character when it comes to bravery. I think part of it is the character of the relationship you have with your spouse, right? And the honesty you have. But also, did your spouse happen to sign up for you going someplace where you're literally going to be in danger? And those are conversations you have to have. And sometimes those don't work out. That's why I know, sadly, a lot of police and emergency rescue folks, those end up in divorces because the same thing. They just can't take it over and over again. What you try to do, I think, is you try to focus folks on your spouse. You try to focus your family on sort of what the importance of the mission is, and you try to get them there. Is that what you found?
Yes, it is. I had, you know, I call it a practice marriage. My first marriage didn't last very long, and that was basically because we were both too young and immature to get married to start with. But my second marriage, we've been married 42 years now, And we dated for 4 years before that. So
you really did the investing time.
Oh, we did. Well, and my wife, Connie, I mean, she's the hero of this family. She had gone through a divorce also, her husband cheating on her with her best friend, of all people.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Connie.
She was a registered nurse, and she loves the trauma, the ER, the ICUs. I mean, the things that I think are gross. And she thinks I'm an idiot because I like the adventure, and I used to. I'm turning into an old man now, so I'm not quite as adventuresome as I used to be.
That's right.
But I think that because we both had those jobs where a lot of times you're in life or death situations, it brought an understanding to our marriage that I don't think we've ever even really come close to split up. We had arguments when we were young newlyweds, but that's just getting used to finances and she's not particularly like to leave me leaving my dirty underwear on the floor in the bathroom. I don't understand that. But that's just joke, everybody. So just try to lighten things up here.
You're going to get a lot of email about that, I'm sure. Wash your damn underwear.
Send them in. I'll forward them to Steve over there.
No, please don't.
You have really experienced a lot of responsibilities in a leadership role. And now you are a keynote speaker, and that's one of your topics where you talk about leadership. So let me just ask you a couple of questions about leadership. What do you think separates a leader from a boss?
A leader from a boss. I think a boss is someone who tells you what to do and assumes it gets done. I think a leader is someone who tells you what needs to be done, gives you the resources, gives you the environment that you need to get it done, and then is there supporting you the entire way.
I know those of you who listen to this, you can't see me, but I'm shaking my head. Yes. I'm shaking my head. Yes, I agree with what he's saying. What leadership mistakes have you seen, specifically in the CIA, that have gotten people hurt?
Gotten people hurt. I think the leadership mistakes that I have seen the most are probably around assuming that people know things, assuming that people are ready for things, not actually having conversations and sitting down with people and saying, hey, Steve, we're going to ask you to do X thing. It's dangerous. Are you ready for that? Are you trained for that? Are you prepared for that? Is your family prepared for that? As opposed to just go do it. And we are, like the organizations you work for, we are extremely mission-driven organization. And you can get caught up in the flag waving and the mission, and you got to get it done because you do got to get it done. But what I would say is you get it done much more effectively. And frankly, you get it done in a much more satisfactory and lasting way if you've taken care of the person and the person's actually able to do it in a more thorough, complete manner, as opposed to just getting it done and getting the hell out. So I think the mistakes I've seen is people assuming people know things, people assuming that they are ready, somebody is ready for something, and not actually sitting down with someone and actually asking them. Ask them. I worked, one of the things, if you looked at my website, one of the things I've done and I'm deeply proud of is I was a senior champion for people with disabilities, including, our wounded warriors and folks who sadly came back from Afghanistan or Iraq with all kinds of disabilities. I was the senior champion there. And one of the I'm sorry, I'm laughing about this, is I was constantly having people come up to me and I would be sort of their go-between and be like, so Steve, I've got a blind officer who's going to start working for me. What do I call her? Did you ask her? Did you ask her? I've got a deaf person. I got this all the time. I've got a deaf person who's going to be starting. Like, what should I do about his IT? Did you ask him?
Yeah.
Ask. And they, you get this look on the face of, oh, I never thought of that. And it goes right back to, are people prepared for what they're doing? So yeah, ask.
Yeah, I'm thinking here, that is so simplistic, but if you've never been in that position before, you don't know what to do, I guess.
Right. And I get the fact that you're nervous. And ultimately, particularly when it came to people with disabilities, people would be nervous because they wanted to do the right thing. I never got that question out of a bad place. It was always because they wanted to do the right thing. They wanted to treat people well, and they wanted to make sure that people had the resources that they need, right? So they would come to me from a good place, but I would say the first thing you need to do is you need to sit down, you need to have a conversation with this person, and you need to ask them the questions you asked me. I can tell you what the textbook answer is. I can tell you what culturally and scientifically the answers are probably going to be, but you need to talk to that person and find out. I can't tell you that your deaf of hard of hearing person is going to need a sign language interpreter, is going to need closed captioning. I can't tell you what their specific needs are. So just ask them, sit down and ask. That's what you should do.
Yep. I like it.
Simple. Keep it simple. Ask.
There you go. Again, on a tangent here, my last position with the government before I retired was a multi-agency fusion center that DEA and DOJ controlled. And as the director, you're always trying to find ways to improve working environment, to improve morale, to make sure people, do you have the tools and the resources and the assets that you need to get your job done? And so I had two deputy directors. One was FBI and one was DHS. And I started a program each year where I would, of the different sections within the office, I would select not supervisors, but worker bees, agents and analysts to come in and have a 30-minute meeting with the boss and say, and the whole thing was, this is non-attributable. Nobody will ever know what you tell me. The notes will be locked in a safe if I keep notes. And if they're not, they'll be shredded by me, not by a secretary. And then just ask them questions. I'm not here to get anybody in trouble, but what can we do better? In which they, the first time, it was like pulling teeth to get people to answer questions because they thought it was a setup. But once they realized that I'm not trying to hurt anybody, I'm just trying to better the environment, years after that, it got better and easier. But the deputy directors and the supervisors under them were like, they was like walking on hot coals. What'd so-and-so say to you? How many times have I told you I'm not going to tell you? This is just for the betterment of the facility. But man, did that caused a lot of consternation among the upper echelon supervisors. And I'm not saying leaders because most of them weren't. A lot of them were. Some were.
Yeah, and I've been extremely fortunate that I've been able to work with some really great leaders at the agency and some not so great leaders. But you talk about the point where once they start to see that you mean it, then you're golden. Getting there is an interesting, how do you get there? But once you've gotten there, you probably heard all kinds of things. People probably just opened up like crazy. And it's more incumbent on you at that point to not be telling the people who are asking the questions that you're doing exactly what you were talking about. Because one of the biggest things we talk about when I would be teaching leadership is your reputation is everything. And if you are a trusted confidant, you're good to go. But as soon as you break that and you only have to do it once, that's it. You got to start all over again.
One time you betray that confidentiality, you're done.
Correct.
Do you think that kindness can actually make someone a better intelligence officer within the agency?
I don't know if it's kindness. There's a lot of talk now about empathy. Should we be using empathy in leadership? Should we not be using empathy in leadership? What I would say is when you're talking about kindness, when you're talking about empathy, understanding where somebody is coming from, understanding their motivations, understanding who they are and frankly, what they want in their career or in their lives. I have always looked at that as intelligence. It's information I have, right? And so if I'm going to shut down on kindness, I'm going to shut down on empathy, you're basically turning off these information sources for you. And so I think if you are kind to someone or you are empathetic to someone, that gives you more information about how they can fit into your larger mission, whatever it happens to be. Now, I'll be very clear. When I'm talking about kindness and I'm talking about empathy, I am not talking about necessarily doing the things they want you to do, because I think that's one of the places, one of the tangents where these conversations go off in the wrong direction. For me, kindness and empathy is sometimes telling somebody some critical feedback. You need to do better on this. You screwed that thing up. We need to have a conversation about how your relationship is with the rest of the team. I consider those to be kind and empathetic if it's coming from me in a place of, I want you to be better, right? So kindness and empathy is not just about shaking my head yes and giving people everything that they want. It's not. And oftentimes it's about telling them some constructive criticisms and telling them no, really telling them no. But it's in a place of, I want them to be better and I need us to obviously meet the mission.
I had an individual I worked with. He served the position of an executive assistant to me, and just extremely intelligent guy, former Washington, D.C. cop, became just an expert in computers and information systems and all that, a confidant, you know, trusting that we could talk about different things. But he taught me the 80-10-10 principle, where 80% of the people seem like they'll come in. They want to do the job. They want to come in and work. They want to be successful. They want to make you proud of the work that they do. The first 10%, well, those people, you can train them, you can work with them to get them up to join that 80%, at least working towards that goal. But then that last 10%, you could tell them, I want you to come to the office 2 days a week between 11 and 2 and go ahead and take your lunch for an hour while you're here. And they still don't want to do a damn thing. But it seemed to be true.
Yeah. And then, so yes. And there's also the 90-10 rule, which is you're going to spend 90% of your time on the 10% of your troublemakers.
That's exactly
so you start
right.
putting this math together. But it's true. So I think one of the things we need to remember is, and I hate to be this guy because it sounds sort of scheming, but there's a place for that 10% of the people. There's a place for the people who come in, want to do their time and get out of the building, right? You give them the things to do that are appropriate for them that you simply need done. And then you give other things to the people who are just with you 100%, are going to work hours. I've been extremely fortunate working for the CIA in that I very rarely had that 10%. I did. But the vast majority of the people, I have to force out of the building. You've been here 12, 13, 14 hours. I can see you starting to collapse, right? I need you to go home because tomorrow we're briefing such and such, and I need you to be sharp. And you almost physically have to push them out. I actually checked to see if a boss could force somebody out of the building. You can't, unless there's like a security threat. It's like, I need something to get them out of the building. Go home. You're a great person, but you're exhausted. And by the way, this brings me back to critical thinking. Like, you're not at your best. Not only are you not at your best, you're probably at like 50%. I need you at 100%. I need you at 100%, which is why I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to actually show interest. I also happen to have liked the vast majority of the people I worked with. But I need you to be a happy person in all the things, your as much as your private life and all the rest of that stuff, so that when you come into work, you are ready at 100% to hit these incredibly difficult missions. So I absolutely 80-10-10. But I think you need to find a space for them. Okay, you're here to do the job. Great. I need you to do the following things. You can check the box. Off you go.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's talk about AI here just a little bit.
Okay. let me pull up my soapbox. What did I do with it?
I think somebody else is going to go off on a tangent here. What worries you most about AI?
What worries the most about AI? So I should say before I answer, I said this before. I'm a huge believer in AI with a number of caveats. And the biggest caveat is the answer to your question. And that is, in order for AI to be effective, AI requires a capable, effective, critical thinking human being in the system. And the thing that worries me the most is that we are not challenging, we are not questioning AI. We are almost putting AI on automatic and letting it do the things for us. That is not a good practice. I don't know about you. I will occasionally, because I guess I'm a curmudgeon, I will occasionally challenge AI. Right. I'll put some question in, and if it comes up with an answer that looks squishy, I will just keep harping back. But there have been numerous times where I've put a simple question into AI and it comes up with absolute garbage, demonstrably false garbage that you call it on it and it will try to justify. It's like, oh, yeah, I got that wrong. And here's why I got that wrong. OK, great. So now you told me why I got it wrong. AI needs a human in the system to run the thing, but to challenge those assumptions. And frankly, the best use of AI, absolute best use of AI, and frankly, the way AI was designed to be used originally was you ask AI something, it gives you back an answer. You clarify your question, you challenge the answer, it comes back with another answer. That iteration, that was the intent of AI. But we've gotten to a place now where people, you know, I talk a lot in the sort of education and learning space, and particularly colleges, universities, but increasingly like grade schools and high schools, people are just, write this thing for me. Copy, paste, there's my report. And it's going to give you garbage. It's going to give you absolute garbage. Or more importantly, what it'll give you, 90% really good with some garbage stuck right in the middle that if you didn't read it, you don't know that you're submitting this thing. It's really interesting. So the answer to your question, thing that worries me the most is we are not thinking enough about the human in the system and making sure that their critical thinking skills are ready for this particular challenge. We're too focused on bringing AI into our workplaces, and it can do a lot of things. We're not focusing on getting the human ready for that particular role. And as a result, we're automating processes based on AI without a human in the system, where we're just not going to be able to have these loops happening and happening and happening again. So that's my several part answer to your question.
Yeah, and you cover several questions that I have in this little section here, but it's
crossing them off.
Do you see? I know the answer to this. But do you believe that these young officers are becoming too dependent on AI? That I'm just going to pop it in there, see what it says, throw it in a report, and let's go.
So I have to think about this one for a minute. I never saw that at the agency. Now remember where my job was. I was chief learning officer. That's an executive function, seventh floor function. For those of you who don't know, seventh floor is the C-suite of the CIA. Literally the seventh floor is where the director, the deputy director, the chief operating officer, now the executive director, they all function. So that's what we call the seventh floor, like leadership. I was really more functioning at that level. I was not down in the lines anymore. I do know that across the federal government, because I've had lots of conversations with feds since I've retired, a lot more than I ever did. Federal agencies are struggling a little bit with this idea of the human in the system. First of all, they're struggling with this AI thing. I don't want to use it because it seems like a scam and everybody's talking about stay away from AI. But then you have those who are like, no, AI can actually do a lot of things. Then you're 80-10-10. You got 10% of the people are like, I don't even have to do that anymore. I can just let AI do it for me. All right. Do you have the humans in the system to look at those things and say, what's going on here? And then as an answer to your question about the reports, I think one of the things that organizations, regardless of what those organizations are, I think an important thing for them to be doing, do you have regulations and structure around the use of AI? Do you have those? And are they particularly set for your mission? I gave a keynote speech recently, a great group of folks in Michigan, right? The Michigan First Responders Learning Conference in, what the hell is it? Grand Rapids. Sorry, Michigan. Grand Rapids is great. I really enjoyed it. Beautiful, beautiful city. I'm going to get emails about that. But it was an amazing conference, and there was a lot of law enforcement, and there were a lot of law enforcement adjacent kinds of operations there. And every time I would have this conversation about AI, you'd see this not only hesitancy, it's an almost aversion to using it. And I didn't understand at the time, but I was talking to a lot of police and first responders. Apparently there's all kinds of lawsuits now. If a beat cop tries to use AI to do their report, which makes complete sense because it can do it like that for you. Apparently now they're being sued because AI wrote the thing. The cop didn't actually read it, the whole thing. And so AI does what AI does, which tries to synthesize and pulls away. But there's ways to program AI to not do those if you're paying attention. So it comes back to, we should be embracing AI. I mean, most podcasts, most of these Zoom calls and everything, every time you log on, you hit a button because someone says that there's a transcript being created that's going to use AI. It's stupid not to use these things. but are federal organizations really thinking about the use of AI and what are the standards that they're going to hold people to? And it ultimately brings me back to those standards and need to have a human somewhere in the system to make sure that what's coming out is actually what you're looking for and legitimate.
If you're not learning about AI, you should. There are things that can help your life, and there's things that you need to be aware of to avoid pitfalls.
Oh, yes. Fairly easy things.
What, and just kind of looking at a global picture here, what countries concern you the most right now?
You're going all over the place, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Look, I told you that I was my undergrad was Soviet studies. My graduate degree was international relations, international policy with a heavy emphasis on Russia and the former Soviet Union. Maybe it's just because I'm an old guy and I can't learn a new trick, but I am still very concerned about that collection of countries, and what's happening there. Right. And then I think I'd probably be booed off of the screen if I didn't also say what's going on in China. And so Russia and the former Soviet Union continue to concern me for all kinds of reasons, to include things like all of the crime that's happening, all of the scams that are based from there, they use all of these kinds of cover places. But then you look at the destabilization of Europe and the destabilization of places like Ukraine, right? I mean, you've got oligarchs in charge of a vast country, an incredibly powerful country with nuclear weapons. And other kinds of weapons too, right? So then you look at the Chinese, and the Chinese have fascinated me. And I'm going to put a disqualifier out there. I never followed China. I never followed China, except part of my job as a biological and chemical weapons analyst was to be aware of what's going on in the outside world, right? And part of my undergraduate and my graduate studies were also in sort of this chem bio area. And one of the things that concerns me the most is biological weapons and China. And yes, people immediately start heading in the direction of COVID and all of that kind of stuff. And again, I did not follow it. I didn't follow COVID. What concerns me the most is what they're doing with genetics. And it's all over the press, right? Every single Chinese citizen, their genetic material is already on file in China, right? So what are they doing with all of this? What could you possibly do with it? And if you've read any good science fiction stuff around biological weapons, you can do a lot. You can do a lot if you've got the DNA of large populations. And I've always been fascinated by DNA and what makes you different from me and what might kill you and might not kill me just based on what your DNA, your genetic code is. It's amazing what the Chinese, I think, are capable of doing in this space. And they're way ahead of us. They are way ahead of us on when it comes to all things bio. All things bio. And that really concerns me and frankly frightens me.
I think that's a very good explanation. And I don't think that enough people here in the United States are aware of the dangers that are out there, which is one of the reasons we have this show here, is to try to educate everybody a little bit more too.
It's really frightening because the Chinese are extremely good at what they do. Extremely good at what they do. Now, at the other end, I would say, again, and I am not a China watcher. I did not follow China as part of my professional background, but I'm an American citizen who's concerned. And so when you look, there are some fundamental cracks in China that are happening. Just look at, speaking of demographics, look at some of the demographics there. I mean, fertility rates are way down. People are having less and less kids because they went through this whole process of preventing people from having too many kids. Now they're at a place where they're starting to see they don't have enough people. And so the population is starting to decline. I mean, these are big deals. They do happen to be very capable when it comes to genetics, however. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think that the China, probably more than anybody, concerns me in how they're getting a technology, but in particular, biotech. And it's extremely interesting. I'll just make a pitch. I finished writing a science fiction, dystopian fiction novel that's based on sort of these differences and what might kill you might not kill me. And I'm also fascinated by how quickly a lot of these illnesses that are out there, viruses, COVID and the like, how quickly they mutate. They just mutate over and over and quick, more and more quickly. And what could a country or what could somebody do with that when you then put on top of it, all of these wearables we've got? I mean, people are not paying attention to these health wearables. And I'm going to throw into that, all of these medical devices, because Bluetooth medical devices that are implants, they're a dime a dozen these days. They're everywhere. Right. And then I've got a Fitbit, I've got a Whoop band, like all of this information's going somewhere. And what about all of that information? And then you've got these viruses and these plagues and all the rest of the stuff that you can manipulate. What could you put all of that together? What could that create? And so that's sort of the launching point for the novel that I've crafted, which is essentially a couple of years in the future. What happens when some of these things start to play out? But it's because I'm fascinated by technology. I'm fascinated by all the information we're just allowing to go off into the ether. And how quickly all of these things mutate.
When do you think that book's going to be available?
I need to be very careful because my probable publisher is probably going to be listening to this probably about 9 months to a year. I've been very slow because I'm trying to figure out what I want to do in my retirement. We've already had this conversation, and I have not yet given them my final manuscript, but that's my job next week is to do that. And I'll let you know. I'll let you know. You'll get a free copy.
Hey, all right. Free as me. What are you most proudest of from your career in the agency?
I think I am most proud of two things. I'm most proud of helping the organization move to a more accessible place for people with disabilities. I've already talked about that. And helping it become a place where people of all kinds, with all kinds of abilities, were able to basically do the absolute best that they could in serving our country, right? Because ultimately, that's why people are at a place like the CIA, is they want to help make our country safe. They want to promote the United States. They want to do the right thing. And so a lot of those folks are actually courageous because they have so many more challenges. I mean, just think about somebody in a motorized wheelchair, how hard that is just their everyday life, right? Now think about navigating a federal agency and a secure one at that. I mean, just getting into a physical building for some of those folks. And again, some of those people I'm talking about are actually wounded warriors who came from overseas, sadly, with all kinds of disabilities, who I think we have a moral obligation to embrace and help do the right thing.
Absolutely.
But I am most proud of helping the organization move into a more accessible, accepting place. And I'll tell you something. What I found working with people with disabilities, and I'm talking about all kinds, physical disabilities, neurodiverse folks, again, wounded warriors, every one of those folks who I ever met and whoever I worked with were problem solvers. They have got to solve problems every single day, if not every single hour and every single minute. Oh, I can't get in this door. Now I got to go find another door. I can't use this particular device. How am I going to accomplish my job? And what I found was that when we embrace those folks and we bring those folks on, the ideas that they give you, the creativity, innovation that you bloom, that they bloom, it just helps you get to the mission even more effectively. So to quickly answer your question, one of the things I'm most proud is moving the organization to a more accessible place, where again, we were open to all kinds of amazing, amazing folks. I think the second thing that I'm most proud of is I was able to set a bit of a role model, serve as a bit of a role model for this. I'm going to call it empathetic, and I know you're probably going to get a lot of hate mail, but this empathetic leadership. I was moved. I got a bit of a reputation fairly early on for being a fixer. Last time I moved into a position, somebody came to me and said, "Steve, you're like the happy Grim Reaper." What the hell does that mean? Is that a compliment? They're like, no, but when you come into a unit, you're sort of happy, but ultimately there's going to be a dramatic change. And so people start to get really worried about what's going to happen to the organization. It's like, okay, I guess I'll take that as a compliment. But I was sent in and I changed a lot of organizations. I had to shut down some organizations, but I also grew and blossomed a lot of organizations, right? And it was through what we talked about before, which is understanding people, communicating with people, really, really understanding what drives them. But most importantly, here's the kicker, getting them to buy into your mission. And when you do that, when they buy into what your mission is, they will work crazy hours. They will do crazy amounts of things because your mission is now their mission. So am I nice to people? I think I am, but ultimately it's from a selfish place because if I'm nice to you and you like working for me, guess what? I'm going to get a lot out of you. And that sounds really calculating and I'm probably going to get a lot of hate mail, but ultimately I think that that's the way to go. And I think I set a bit of a role model there and I hope people take that away.
Oh, Barry, that's absolutely something to be proud of. Absolutely. So why did you decide to retire from the CIA?
There's the question now. So I always had my eye on sort of the number 30. It's a clean number. I tend to be one of these guys that I like clean numbers and I like lists. I'm a guy who checks off lists. And yes, if I did something else, I will add it to the list and check it off because by God, I deserve to check that off my list.
I'm the same way.
There's nothing wrong with it. You accomplished that thing, right? Why can't I check it off? So I've been thinking a lot, probably the last 5 or 6 years. It's like, you know what? 30 seems like a really round number. And by the way, I also happened to turn a big age this year with a zero at the end, which freed up all of my 401k so I can access all of that. Really put sort of Social Security in play in a couple of years if I choose to do that. All of the numbers really sort of made sense for me. And so I've been really aiming at this for a while. And then I told you 20 years ago, I said that I wanted to be the chief learning officer. Almost as if somebody was telling me, okay, Steve, this is it. I got that particular job. Okay, 30 years it is. And I also, we folks like you and me and folks like many of the people who you've interviewed, working for the government, it's a challenge, right? And it wears you down. And someone said to me that once you retire, it's going to take you 6 to 7 months before your body physically and your brain physically adjust to not being on call, not being constantly under the tension of, am I going to have to go in? Am I going to have to go in? Oh, wait. There seems to be bombing again in the Strait of Hormuz. So I'm about to get a phone call and I'm going to have to go in, right? It takes you a while to come down off of that high. I suspect you probably went through that. Did you go through that? Like, yeah.
You do. And it was a good thing that your phone's not going off in the middle of the night, especially one of those calls. You get a call in the middle of the night. There's never good news. It's not, hey, you're doing a great job. Thanks. Something's going
That's
wrong.
Right. That's right. Director just wanted you to know he really likes you. Thanks a lot. Yeah, and I got lots of phone calls in the middle of the night. So I thought, I've got this book idea in my head. I've written the book. Now I need to really just do something with it. I'd like to do some speaking. I'd like to have time for myself to do the things to do, as you said, sort of check off the honey-do list, get that done, which is pretty much already done. But I'm at a place where I'm still physically healthy enough to do some things that I want to do. I want to raft through the Colorado River, right through the Grand Canyon. Clock is ticking for how long my body's going to be able to do that. I want to go to base camp out in Nepal, right? I have no intention of climbing that thing. I have a friend who's a professional climber and he's done it numerous times. God bless that man. No intention to do it, but I'd like to be at base camp, right? So you want to do these things while you still can enjoy them. And I think that's the point here. And I want to do some volunteer work, particularly around people with disabilities and some other causes. I thought, okay, let's take that break. And by the way, there are great people behind me who can take those positions. So how's that for a long answer to a short question?
That's a good question. It's a good idea. And it's part of having a plan and then sticking to the plan.
Right.
All right, so I've been hit with some unexpected questions here. So let's just have a little fun here with some rapid fire. courtesy of a Game of Crimes member, Rick Jacobson. Rick, thank you for this idea. We've been doing it for several episodes now, and it seems to be pretty popular. So I'll just give you, and I'll give you choices here, and you let me know what you think. It could be one. It could be a one-word answer. It could be an explanation if you want it to be. It's yours. First up, coffee or tea?
Coffee, 100%.
Me too. Early bird or night owl?
Early bird.
Me too. Best leadership book?
Wow. Best leadership book. So my favorite leadership book is called Leadership and Self-Deception by the Arbinger Institute. Probably the most fundamentally transformative book. And I hate to use that term, but it really made me think hard about a number of things that I'd never thought about before. And it's all about self-awareness, because ultimately the place where leaders make the biggest mistakes, I don't care where you're working, is through self-awareness of themselves, obviously, awareness. And that's a book that really helped me understand the dialogue that was going on in my head. And then I'd throw in Covey's Seven Habits, because it just really, really helped me. How was that?
Excellent.
Have you read either of those?
It's Covey's I have.
Okay. Okay.
Best spy novel.
Okay, I'm going to be honest with you.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Yeah. I hate spy novels.
Okay.
I hate spy movies. I'm not the guy that's going to sit there and say, that's not the way it happens. That's not the way it happens. Because for me, it's all entertainment. I think if you're going to really sort of push me up against the wall, my favorite is probably going to be an oldie, which is, the book is 7 Days of the Condor. And I think the movie is 3 Days of the Condor. I think they changed. Great. Both of them are great. But I like old school. And again, it's Soviet era. That makes me warm and fuzzy.
Yeah. What's the most...
Oh, yours. Wait, what's yours? I want to know the answer.
I had Jack Carr on here.
Oh, yeah.
The last couple of months. I love his books. But I like them all. It's an adventure that you're going through. And I have the ability, I hope most people do, that you can visualize in your brain as you're reading and kind of put yourself in the position and picture where a good writer will lead you down to where you can actually see the scenery. You're in the jungle, you're in an airplane flying somewhere, whatever you're doing. Yeah. Good stuff. Most overrated leadership advice.
Most overrated leadership advice. So I actually got a piece of advice when I was about to get promoted, and the leadership advice was, you need to give less spotlight to your subordinates. This is an exact quote. You need to give less spotlight to your subordinates, and you need to take the spotlight more. Otherwise, people are going to think you're not doing your job. I did not follow that advice. And in fact, I did the opposite of that advice, and I just gave my subordinates even more of the spotlight. And what I found was, it just goes back to they're 100% in with you. If you're giving them the kudos and you're giving them the praise, my mission is being accomplished, and I'm accomplishing it with people who are really quite happy because I'm giving them the praise. I'll never forget that advice, because it was from somebody who I actually thought was a really good leader. And when he said to me, you really need to stop giving your subordinates the spotlight and you need to be in the spotlight more, I was like, that seems really, really bad.
Yeah. All right. What's the favorite place that you've traveled to?
Wow. Okay. So I traveled there recently, so this is probably why it's at the top of my list. My favorite place is probably Normandy, France. I had on my list of travel to do's, I always wanted to go to Normandy. I wanted to go to the beaches. And so we did a tour, great company, and they take you all across, Normandy, Brittany and Normandy. And I was so focused on the Normandy beaches, which are every patriotic American should go. Just to be there and see the actual places where so many people died for their freedoms. But then I discovered things like Normandy food and Normandy culture. And I discovered this thing called Normandy cider, which I am now absolutely in love with. Of course, it costs about $1 zillion in this country. So Normandy, and the beaches, have you been? You've been to Normandy?
No, but I'd love to go.
Oh my gosh. It is. I was on the Normandy beaches and you're standing there, beautiful beach. And I'm standing there pretty much alone, but over I look and there's a family who's got a picnic out on the beach. There's a dog running up and down. There's kids over on the side who are playing. And the first thing you think about is, this is sacrilege. Like, this is holy ground. And then you think, no, actually, this is exactly the way it needs to be.
Yes.
Because these people gave their lives so that everybody could be free and do this, right? And then you've got some of the German pillboxes that are ruined that are up in the hills. You can still see them. And it's just so unbelievably moving standing there and realizing what we did and what we went through. So it has to be Normandy.
My dad was, he was in World War II in Europe and did another contract job with the Army's Office of Military Commissions. And we ended up doing a TUI over to Belgium. And we took a long weekend and I got to go through Bastogne and my dad had gone through there when he was over there.
Man.
I get goosebumps just talking about it now, but that's the effect that it has on you. And you nailed it when you said that's why we have the freedoms we have now, is because of the brave men and women back then that stood up to the call.
Yeah, when we went to Normandy, I read, someone has suggested, I'm going to, of course, blow it. It's a town in Virginia that lost the most amount of men in any single battle. It just slipped my mind. I'm sorry. But I read this account, and what I didn't realize was that this unit was literally the first one off the boats. So they're getting mowed down, right? And it's a factual story, but it's told through the letters that they were writing back and forth to each other. And so I just finished the book before we got to Normandy. And so you get off the bus or whatever, you're standing and I was like, oh my gosh. So goosebumps.
Yep. Man, we're coming up to the end here. We're running out of time. What's the most dangerous position you ever found yourself in during your career, if it's unclassified?
Let's see. I was involved with a car bomb, but I just got a concussion. Lots of rocket attacks. I mean, I hate to say it because it sounds sort of like, just this. Oh, no, I know exactly. The most dangerous place I was ever in. So I took a bit of a break, and I worked for the Office of the Secretary of Defense. For those of you who don't work in Washington, like, you've got the Department of Defense, and then you've got the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and how they work together, it's a whole thing, right? So I was working for the Office of the Secretary of Defense in the late 90s, and I was running. Do you remember a thing called the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, CTR?
No.
Remember it? Okay. So Cooperative Threat Reduction was a thing in the 90s where the U.S., working with the states of the former Soviet Union, we got intelligence and reports and everything that terrorists were going to try to get some of the chemical and biological and nuclear materials from some of the old facilities. So the U.S. Worked with a lot of states of the former Soviet Union, but also other states, to go in and basically demilitarize, help them and help pay for demilitarizing some of those sites or securing some of those sites so that the bad guys couldn't get a hold of whatever it happened to be. I went over to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and I was actually running the chem bio portfolio for a number of these countries. So I got to go to places like Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, where the Soviet Union had done a lot of testing of both chemical and biological facilities. And so one trip took me to one of the Soviet Union's former biological weapons facilities, testing facilities. And what I didn't realize, because I was so focused on what they had done there, I didn't realize that also it is infested with vipers and cobras.
Oh, no. And so,
yes. And by the way, one of the things I learned is cobras, unlike in the movies, cobras actually will try to get away from you. They will only do that whole hooded thing if they think they're being threatened, right? So they actually go away from you. Vipers, on the other hand, are little sons of bitches. They're going to come after you. And so, like, I had a sidearm, and, like, I was, you know, I'm not going to say dancing around shooting them, but at the same time, it was like, that was probably the closest I came, having these little nasties, and they're deadly. So yeah, that's probably the...
Oh, man. I'm definitely afraid of snakes. I can handle a lot of things, but not snakes.
Yeah. So not technically for the agency, but in my career, that's where I was probably the most in danger.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk just a second here about what you're doing today, and mentioned this yesterday when we opened the show, that you're a keynote speaker, that you're a leadership advisor, consultant, you're a writer of dystopian future fiction. And I got to be honest with you, I had to look up dystopian. I wasn't sure what you're talking about there, but
oh, sorry.
I know now.
You know, you're welcome.
Keep it simple thing you talked about.
Yeah.
But if you're looking for keynote speakers, and let me just get this up, because we met because we share the same talent agency at United Talent Agency. That's David Buchalter. You can reach out to David Buchalter, and it's David.Buchalter, B-U-C-H-A-L-T-E-R, at UnitedTalent.com.
Great guy. Great guy.
He's fantastic. Fantastic. You can find Steve here on his website, Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Hirsch, H-I-R-S-C-H.com. And you can also find him on LinkedIn at Steve Hirsch. You heard him talk about leadership and some of his thoughts, and pretty much everything you said, Steve, aligns with the way I believe in things. I'm not as an accomplished speaker as you are, because you hear me stumbling over my words here on the podcast. I've only been doing this. This is my sixth year. I think I'll pick it up at some point. But if you're looking for keynote speakers for your corporate events, for your college events, whatever, give this guy a shot. Take a look at him. He really needs a position where they could videotape him, because David's dying to get him on videotape.
I appreciate that. I work for the CIA. I don't have videotape.
That's it. You know, and that's the one thing with David. When there's somebody that I want to recommend, hey, you might want to consider this guy as a potential speaker, or they got videotape, that's the first thing you ask.
Yes.
So now when people come to me, I'm looking for a speaker. That's the first thing I tell them, is you need to make a video of yourself speaking so people can see what you look like.
Right.
Is there anything I've missed that you would like to mention, Steve?
You covered it all, and I really, really appreciate the pitch. Really, really appreciate the pitch. I appreciate my time here. I'm happy to work with anybody. I love all kinds of organizations. I love working with all kinds of different people. Obviously, you heard me. If you've been paying attention, you heard me on my numerous soapboxes about AI and sort of leadership, and including empathy and understanding in that leadership, and especially around accessibility and people with disabilities. If you want to reach out and talk to me about dystopian future, which now Steve can tell you all about what dystopian means.
I can't spell it, but I can tell you.
That's right. Or sort of where we're going in this world of modern technology, particularly modern technology. I'm happy to have a chat with you.
Excellent. And you heard us talk also about his 5-minute drills on LinkedIn. Check those out. I'll look at them. And I'm looking at one. It's the Teach It Simply test. And we talked about that offline a little bit. And then there's another one I see on here, and he's got these nice charts that makes it easier for people like me. And it just went off of my screen.
Not that I thought of few, but.
you knew who your audience was today. That was me.
You said it.
But everybody can benefit from learning techniques about leadership. I mean, you can always look to improve yourself. And this can apply not just to your professional career, but also to your family, your friends. Nobody wants to hang out with a dumbass. They would want to do that. They could hang out with me.
I think that's going to be my new logo. Nobody wants to hang out with a dumbass.
And I met this from one. I mean, I got this from one. Before I let you go, this is the last question. So after 30 years helping to shape people that protect our country, what words of advice would you have for anyone that's considering a career in intelligence or law enforcement or the military?
Critical thinking skills, because I think all of those organizations are really beginning to hone in on this idea of, we need people who can make decisions in great duress. And so they're starting. And if I have anything to do about it, they're going to do even more in this critical thinking space. I would talk to colleagues. I would talk to people. I have tons of people who reach out to me on LinkedIn and frankly other places about, hey, I'm thinking about going into the intelligence community. Can you tell me about X, Y, or Z? So use networks to get there. But one other thing is, you've really got to prepare yourself to be flexible. You've got to prove that you're agile, that we may hire you for one thing, but ultimately you may end up doing something else. I was a chemical and biological weapons analyst. If you look at my career, I bounced all over the place, right?
Right.
Deputy Director of Public Affairs, Chief Learning Officer. I led business analytics. I helped with data analytics. We are looking for people who can move around and do those things, right? And the other thing is, obviously, this is probably the biggest question I get, particularly today. 6 months, you can't have used pot. 6 months, no marijuana use. I know that some states are making it illegal. Federal law still says it. Literally, I will get an email that says, "Hey, I'm interested in the intelligence community. What's the position on marijuana?" Well, if that's your first question, I don't know how well you're going to do, but it is 6 months before they actually let you in, and your online presence is extremely important.
And I'm pretty sure they don't want to hear anybody that's going to come in and say, "Well, that's not my job." It's probably going to be your job.
That's probably going to be your job. They don't want to hear it.
Oh, man. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show. And a shout out to Dave Buchalter again for the introduction here. You brought some good humor to an agency that's very secretive. It's easy to bash the CIA, and I've said this here several times on the show and actually on stage as well doing presentations, that I had trouble with the CIA when we were in Columbia, but it was one person. Well, and I think his deputy chief station was probably involved with it as well, but maybe he's just following orders. But I don't want to know everything that our CIA is doing, because then they're going to divulge secrets that protect you and me. Right. So it's keep doing what you're doing, CIA. Thank you for your service to the country here, not only through the CIA, but your military service as well. Your whole career, your whole adult life has been serving your fellow man. And in my book, there's no greater calling.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you for your service.
Yeah, they just needed a token hillbilly, and that was it. Bring Murphy up. He'll do it. He'll do it. It's like Mikey. Give it to Mikey. He'll eat anything. We have it to Mike. He'll do anything.
And here you are today with all of your great merch.
There we go. There you go. Check out these shirts. You might see them online for sale soon. And if you're listening to this, now you got to go over to YouTube and see what the shirt looks like, right?
That's right.
Cheesy commercials again. Steve, thanks so much, brother. It's a true honor and pleasure to have you on here.
Been my pleasure.
Oh, thank you, sir. And ladies and gentlemen, I thank the world of you for continuing to give me your time. Yeah, check us out on the other. If come over and check us out on YouTube. I say that about 1,000 times, and one of these days you're going to start listening to what I say, I hope. which is kind of leads me to the closing here. Why do you continue to come back here? It's because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's the game of crimes. God bless you all. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, all.